time when Sturzok and the FBI were believed to have been compiling their unverified dossier to bring to a FISA court judge to gain a warrant to spy on Carter Page. In another audacious text, Sturzok states, "I'm in charge of espionage for the FBI. Any espionage FISA comes before him." As the Federalist reported, the pair even schemed about how to set up a cocktail or dinner party just so Contreras, Sturzok, and Page could speak without arousing suspicions that they were colluding. Whether the dinner party ever took place is unclear. What is clear is that congressional investigators were convinced these texts were intentionally concealed from Congress and never turned over in an unredacted form. The texts may also be evidence of attempted undue influence of a judge, which would constitute obstruction of justice and potentially other crimes. The Flynn case was handed off to another judge, U.S. District Court Judge Emmett G. Sullivan. He may have suspected something was amiss. Federal prosecutors and law enforcement are notorious for withholding exculpatory evidence. Sullivan had experience in the matter, having once presided over the corruption prosecution of former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, who was convicted. When it was later learned that prosecutors had been withholding evidence and creating false testimony, Judge Sullivan excoriated them and held them in contempt. The indictment against Stevens was then set aside, vacating the conviction. After Flynn's guilty plea, Judge Sullivan ordered Mueller's team of prosecutors to produce any information which is favorable to defendant and material either to defendant's guilt or punishment. This government responsibility includes producing, during plea negotiations, any exculpatory evidence in the government's possession. Judge Sullivan pointed out that prosecutors had a responsibility to hand over to the defense any information that would have been helpful to him before he decided to enter his guilty plea. A fourth reason the charge against Flynn should not have been brought is that the FBI had no legal basis even to question him because his conversations with Kislyak were not a crime. It is the job of the FBI to investigate crimes or potential crimes. They must have a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. Yet, as previously explained, the Trump transition team's interactions with the Russian ambassador were perfectly normal. Where was the crime? Nowhere. What reasonable suspicion existed? None. Dialogues with foreign governments occurred during every transition. Some are quite lengthy and involved, as the new administration prepares itself for the foreign policy challenges that lay ahead. It would be profoundly unusual if they did not happen. In no way did Flynn's discourse with Kislyak violate the Logan Act, which prohibits private citizens from interfering in diplomatic disputes between the U.S. and foreign governments. For more than 200 years since the passage of the Act in 1799, no one has ever been prosecuted under it. The reason is quite simple. The law is regarded by most legal scholars as contrary to the First Amendment and, therefore, unconstitutional. Since no person has ever been convicted, no court has ever ruled directly on its constitutionality. However, courts have commented on the Act from time to time. In 1964, the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York stated that it was likely unconstitutional because it is vague, overly broad, and ambiguous. Numerous scholarly publications have argued that the Act violates the right to free speech under the First Amendment, so its legal efficacy is doubtful. Beyond that, the newly named National Security Advisor did nothing that would fall under the Act. He was serving as a representative of the incoming government, not as a private citizen as the Act requires. Moreover, Flynn did not interfere in a diplomatic dispute under the meaning of the Logan Act. To the contrary, he sought ways to de-escalate tensions over U.S. sanctions by asking the Russian government to limit its response in a reciprocal manner. He helped to prevent an international confrontation that could have intensified into something far more serious. By doing this, Flynn was acting for the benefit of the U.S. government and in a manner not inconsistent with the Obama administration's wishes and policy. He could hardly be criticized for it, much less prosecuted. In the statement of offense against Flynn, the special counsel also cited calls made by Flynn to Russia and several other countries requesting that foreign officials vote against or delay a United Nations Security Council resolution. However, this too would not fall under the Logan Act. The proposed resolution condemned Israel's settlements as a flagrant violation of international law. This surely came as no surprise to the Russians or the Obama administration, since it conformed with the same public statement President-elect Trump issued the very day Flynn contacted the Russians about the pending vote. Trump tweeted, "The resolution being considered at the United Nations Security Council regarding Israel should be vetoed." There was nothing secretive or illegal about Flynn's communications with Moscow, and in the end it did not matter. Russia ignored Flynn's request and voted in favor of the resolution, which passed with 14 votes. The U.S., under the direction of the Obama administration, took no position on the resolution. By abstaining, it neither supported the resolution nor opposed it. And since the measure imposed no sanctions, it was nothing more than an idle diplomatic statement. The FBI's motives in interviewing Flynn can be traced to Sally Yates, an Obama holdover who was acting Attorney General until Jeff Sessions could be confirmed by the Senate and sworn into office. Yates would later be fired by Trump when she refused to have the Justice Department defend his initial executive order on immigration, almost certainly because she disagreed with the policy. Her antipathy toward the new president made her a darling of the anti-Trumpers, even though her act of defiance was nothing more than classic insubordination. The president, in his decision to terminate her, was well within his Article II powers under the Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. However, while she was still acting Attorney General, it was Yates who directed Comey's agents to interview Flynn. As America's top law enforcement official, she must have known the Logan Act had no application, and she had, therefore, no legal justification for instructing the Bureau to even speak with Flynn. She ordered the agents to do it anyway, perhaps hoping to inveigle him in a way that would damage the new president. If Yates had been acting in good faith, she would have notified the White House counsel that the FBI wanted to speak to Flynn about a matter that involved a potential crime. She did not do so, and neither did the FBI Director Comey. Had the White House been made aware of this critical information, it would either have rejected the interview outright for lack of legal cause, or otherwise ensured that Flynn was represented by a lawyer during the interview. He was not. It was a seemingly unprincipled maneuver by Yates, but she was far from done. Undeterred by the agents who reportedly concluded that Flynn had not lied, Yates nonetheless decided to visit the White House 2 days after the interview. According to her testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, she warned White House counsel Don McGahn that Flynn would be vulnerable to blackmail by the Russians because he had been deceptive about his discussions with Kislyak. This, of course, was a nonsensical scenario because FBI agents had determined that Flynn was telling the truth. In what way could the Russians use the truth as blackmail? Yates left out this tiny but important fact. Here is her account, which stands as a textbook case of implying guilt by omission. "We also told the White House counsel that General Flynn had been interviewed by the FBI on February 24th. Mr. McGahn asked me how he, Flynn, did, and I declined to give him an answer to that." Why didn't Yates tell McGahn the truth, that FBI agents felt Flynn had given honest answers? Because that would have ruined the canard she was spinning that Moscow would somehow try to blackmail Flynn over a purported lie that was no lie at all. It is reasonable to conclude that Yates, who had been appointed by Obama, wanted the new president to fire Flynn, thereby wreaking havoc at the outset of his administration and generating a public scandal that would damage Trump. She seemed determined to make it happen, as her testimony revealed. "Finally, we told them, the White House counsel's office, that we were giving them all of this information so that they could take action, the action that they deemed appropriate. I remember that Mr. McGahn asked me whether or not General Flynn should be fired, and I told him that that really wasn't our call, that was up to them, but that we were giving them this information so that they could take action, and that was the first meeting." Yates did not, however, give the White House the full information. She seemed to have cherry-picked what could be misconstrued as fatal to Flynn, while concealing a fact that would have likely exonerated the advisor. It was a clever but unethical deception. If Yates had been forthcoming, she would have admitted that the Logan Act was not violated and that FBI agents had believed that Flynn did not lie to them. She should have then apologized for commandeering the FBI for a legally invalid purpose and promptly resigned. Of course, she did not do this. J. Christian Adams, a former Justice Department attorney, told Fox News he had no doubt about Yates's motivation. She saw it as her mission to sabotage the incoming administration, We know she did it on the travel ban. Now we know she did it to screw over General Flynn. The damage wrought by Yates accomplished the desired goal. Shortly after her visit to the White House, Flynn resigned as National Security Advisor amid mounting news accounts of impropriety. Illicit or corrupt actions in the treatment of Flynn were compounded by Comey and the deception he begat in numerous public statements during his book tour. In television interviews, he repeatedly insisted that he never told Congress that FBI agents who interviewed Flynn did not believe he had intentionally lied. Yet days later, the House Intelligence Committee made public a newly unredacted report that the FBI and DOJ had tried to block. It included quotes from a transcript of Comey's testimony. Director Comey testified to the committee that the agents discerned no physical indications of deception. They didn't see any change in posture, in tone, in inflection, in eye contact. They saw nothing that indicated to them that he knew he was lying to them. According to the Senate Judiciary Committee in a letter dated May 11, 2018, Comey specifically told their committee the same thing, that agents who interviewed Flynn saw nothing that led them to believe he was lying. Was Comey lying when he testified before both congressional committees? Or was he lying during televised interviews to the American public in order to profit from his book? The disinformation, false accusations, and wrongful prosecution of Flynn invite another significant legal question. Who leaked Flynn's conversations to the press? Whomever did so committed a crime. The leakers committed a crime, not Flynn. Someone in the federal government had access to the content of the Flynn-Kislyak conversations secretly recorded by American intelligence agencies. The tapes and their transcripts were classified documents. Despite this, someone appears to have conveyed them to Washington Post reporter David Ignatius, a highly regarded journalist who published the information in an initial column on January 12, 2017. According to a senior U.S. government official, Flynn phoned Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak several times on December 29th, the day the Obama administration announced the expulsion of 35 Russian officials as well as other measures in retaliation for the hacking. Several other stories followed in the next few weeks, including the very day Yates visited the White House to talk about Flynn. The original and subsequent leaks were felonies by those who provided the information. Title 18 of the USC, Section 798, states as follows. Whoever knowingly and willfully communicates, furnishes, transmits, or otherwise makes available to an unauthorized person, or publishes any classified information concerning the communication intelligence activities of the United States or any foreign government, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both. It matters not that the government leakers intended to reveal a deception by Flynn, assuming there was one, and the facts indicate otherwise. Any underlying motivation to serve the public good by disclosing a lie or misrepresentation is of no legal consequence under the statute. Ignatius described the person who first told him of Flynn's recorded discussions with Kislyak as a senior U.S. government official. That person committed the crime stated above. Was it Yates? Was it James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence? Both had access to the recorded conversations. But it was Yates who used the contents to engineer Flynn's firing at roughly the same time information was leaked to Ignatius and others. In their sworn testimony before Congress, both Yates and Clapper stated that they had no idea who leaked the information. The Washington Post published numerous articles as Yates and the FBI were targeting Flynn. In most of the stories, the reporters added new information that could have only come from government sources who had access to the classified recordings or other materials. In one such story, the Post revealed that the Flynn-Kislyak conversations were corroborated by 9 current or former officials who were in senior positions at multiple agencies at the time of the calls, spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss intelligence matters. The reference to multiple agencies is especially disturbing. It indicates pervasive criminality across many of the 16 agencies that make up the U.S. intelligence community, all of whom could have gained access to the secret recordings of Flynn and leaked them to the press. The government has immense resources at its disposal to aggressively investigate these classified leaks. Individuals who illegally disclosed the information should be prosecuted as the law demands. This is particularly true since the evidence suggests that the cavalcade of media reports implying criminality on the part of Flynn likely contributed to his forced departure as a national security advisor. Sessions mistakenly recused himself from Russian investigation. Jeff Sessions was only 3 weeks on the job as Attorney General when he held a news conference on March 2, 2017, to announce that he would recuse himself from any investigations involving Russia and the 2016 presidential campaign. He should never have done so. Neither the facts nor the law required his recusal. It was a grievous mistake that relegated the Attorney General to a meaningless bystander to events that threatened to overtake the new administration. It also angered President Trump, who felt Sessions should have stood firm in the face of unwarranted criticism instead of backing down. Trump was correct in his assessment. He was entirely justified in his displeasure and frustration. Sessions had deceived his boss by concealing his intent to recuse himself from the federal investigation into Russia's meddling in the 2016 election and any connections between the Trump campaign and Moscow. By his own admission during a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing in June 2017, Sessions began setting his recusal in motion within hours after being sworn in as Attorney General on February 9th. On his first full day as AG, he stated that he immediately met with Justice Department officials to discuss stepping aside from the case and took preliminary steps to do so. Trump apparently had no idea this was going on behind closed doors at the DOJ. Here is part of Sessions' testimony. I basically recused myself the first day I got into office because I never accessed files. I never learned the names of investigators. I never met with them. I never asked for any documentation. Clearly, Sessions was considering disqualifying himself well before he took the oath of office. It was not something that dawned on him the moment he raised his right hand in the Oval Office ceremony. And there stood the president, expecting his new attorney general to serve the nation fully and honestly. The next day, Sessions began his recusal, but did not make it official or public until 3 weeks later. Failing to disclose such a material matter to the president was a serious betrayal. Perhaps the former senator from Alabama was so desperate for the job that he did not care that his recusal might undermine the presidency of the man who nominated him to be the nation's chief law enforcement officer. Or maybe Sessions was naive in convincing himself that neglecting to disclose such a material matter was somehow inconsequential. It was not. Trump was disgusted and angry when he learned of the recusal. At a news conference in the Rose Garden, he vented, "I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply picked somebody else. So I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency." While it was unconventional, if not unprecedented, for a sitting president to publicly disparage his attorney general, Trump was right. He was entitled to know the truth, but Sessions actively hid it from him. He deserved an attorney general who, at the outset, was forthright about his intentions, not someone who was concealing his plan to step aside from a major investigation that would surely impact the new administration. In doing so, the attorney general sandbagged the president. Sessions' deception also deprived him of Trump's confidence and trust, which are essential to the job of Attorney General. This ethical impropriety rendered Sessions unfit to serve. But for Sessions' deceit, it is unlikely that a special counsel would have been appointed. Instead, Sessions' replacement in the Russia case, Acting Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, took it upon himself to appoint Robert Mueller to preside over the proof. This played neatly into the scheme admittedly devised by fired FBI Director James Comey, who just happened to be Mueller's close friend and longtime professional ally. This will be explored in the next section of this chapter. Sessions told the Senate Intelligence Committee he was required to recuse himself under the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 28 of the CFR, Section 45.2. However, this was an incorrect reading of the rules. The language of this section offers broad latitude and discretion for Sessions to have remained involved. The ethical standard is a subjective one. Moreover, a strict reading of the regulations does not cover a matter like the Russia probe as it existed at the time of his recusal. When Sessions was sworn in, the FBI's examination of Russian meddling was officially a counterintelligence case, not a criminal investigation, according to Comey's sworn testimony. It is a critical distinction. Here is how the regulation reads in relevant part. No employee shall participate in a criminal investigation or prosecution if he has a personal or political relationship with, 1. Any person or organization substantially involved in the conduct that is the subject of the investigation or prosecution, or, 2. Any person or organization which he knows has a specific and substantial interest that would be directly affected by the outcome of the investigation or prosecution. The operative words in the regulation are criminal investigation or prosecution. At the moment of Sessions's recusal, neither of these two conditions were present. If the Bureau's investigation had in fact been criminal when Sessions took office, then arguably he might have been correct in recusing himself, but it was not. At roughly the same time the Attorney General disqualified himself, FBI Director James Comey told the House Intelligence Committee that the investigation into Russian meddling was a counterintelligence case, which involved information gathered by law enforcement to protect against espionage. Significantly, the case had not advanced to the stage of an official criminal probe, much less a prosecution, as the recusal regulation prescribes. Former federal prosecutor Andrew McCarthy published two excellent columns explaining the distinction and then concluded as follows. Counterintelligence investigations should not trigger disqualification or recusal of an attorney general unless and until the investigation turns up incriminating evidence that could form the basis for a criminal investigation and a possible prosecution. It was unnecessary for Sessions to recuse himself from the broader counterintelligence investigation. It is not a criminal inquiry, and Regulation 45.2 explicitly applies only to criminal investigation or prosecution. McCarthy's point was that Sessions relied on a recusal rule that applied to an altogether different kind of investigation, not the one taking place when the Attorney General mistakenly disqualified himself. Assuming Comey's description of the case to Congress was accurate, there was no evidence of criminality connected to the Trump campaign and, thus, no need for Sessions to have removed himself, as McCarthy explained. What about Flynn, who had been questioned by the FBI and fired by Trump? This had nothing to do with Russia's interference in the election and no correlation to activities of the Trump campaign. It was triggered by the FBI's and DOJ's misapplication of the Logan Act, as noted earlier, seemingly unconnected to a counterintelligence probe by the Bureau. Sessions might have been compelled to recuse himself from the Flynn investigation, but there was no requirement that he step aside from a counterintelligence investigation related to Russia. When Sessions consulted officials at the Justice Department the day he arrived, he may well have been misled by those Obama holdovers who had been running the department for the last 8 years. Were their recommendations that he disqualify himself influenced by their political convictions? Quite possible. It is also conceivable that they did not bother to apprise themselves of the true nature of the FBI's investigation. Had they done so, they would have realized that a counterintelligence matter in no way required disqualification of the Attorney General under the relevant regulation. Sessions's contacts with Kislyak were negligible. Their only meaningful discussion during the election occurred when Sessions was acting in his official capacity as a U.S. senator, not as a surrogate of the Trump campaign. He insisted they never spoke about the election. Why, then, did he feel compelled to recuse himself from a matter involving Russia's interference in the election? If he answered all questions truthfully in his confirmation hearing and was, therefore, uninvolved in any alleged collusion with the Russian ambassador, there was no valid reason for him to disqualify himself from overseeing the FBI's counterintelligence probe. Instead, Sessions capitulated to the demands by Democrats and some Republicans for his removal, which were based on misrepresentations of their meeting. Sessions unwittingly played neatly into the hands of Trump's political adversaries. The Attorney General recused himself from a case that, by legal definition, did not involve a crime that can be found anywhere in America's criminal codes. Indeed, there was no criminal investigation at the time he disqualified himself. Did he not read the statutory law? Did he not comprehend the recusal regulation he cited? What prosecutor removes himself from a criminal investigation that might not happen and based on a law that does not exist? Sessions reacted incorrectly to a politically driven narrative that had no support in the law. Other attorneys general have presided over investigations involving potential crimes within their administration. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, for example, oversaw the FBI's criminal investigation of Hillary Clinton in its entirety. Even when her involvement was revealed in the infamous tarmac meeting with Bill Clinton, she did not recuse herself. Instead, she said she would accept the recommendations of the FBI. In her testimony before the House Judiciary Committee, she admitted that she was the person who made the decision not to charge Clinton with any crimes. If ever there was an instance in which an attorney general should have recused herself under Regulation 45.2, it was the Clinton case. Yet Lynch declined to do so despite her private and personal contact with the husband of the subject of the investigation. By comparison, Sessions had no known contact with anyone suspected of being involved in Russian meddling in the 2016 campaign. Yet, he recused himself in the confused or misguided belief that he was required to do so. Lynch was obligated under the law, but Sessions was not. Sessions can be legitimately criticized for a variety of failures. He resisted producing documents involving the anti-Trump dossier, which were subpoenaed by the House Intelligence Committee. He spent months ignoring pleas from members of Congress to reopen the case against Hillary Clinton for likely violations of the Espionage Act in the use of her private email server, obstruction of justice for destroying more than 30,000 emails under congressional subpoena, and potential self-dealing for profit through her foundation. His efforts to investigate the unmasking of Trump aides during intelligence surveillance by the Obama administration appeared less than vigorous. His reluctance to investigate the possible criminal conduct of James Comey is baffling, given substantial evidence that the fired FBI director may have falsely testified before Congress, stolen government documents, and leaked them to the media. Of course, contorting the law to clear Clinton was deserving of its own investigation. Sessions may have been a decent United States senator, but in his first year in office he proved to be an ineffectual, feckless attorney general whose only real achievement seemed to be alienating the president. Amid Trump's public denunciations of Sessions, he offered a letter of resignation which was, regrettably, not accepted by the commander-in-chief. Trump was right when he said that choosing Sessions as attorney general was one of the worst decisions he had made. Among Sessions' many mistakes, recusing himself from the Russia investigation had the most serious consequence for the Trump presidency and the country. Had he maintained his authority over the matter, it is doubtful that a special counsel would ever have been appointed, and Comey's manipulations upon being fired would have been the subject of an appropriate investigation by someone other than the department's inspector general, who has no jurisdiction to compel Comey or other departed FBI agents to answer questions or produce documents. The firing of James Comey. James Comey should have been fired the day he held a very public news conference in July 2016, announcing his recommendation that Hillary Clinton not be criminally prosecuted for mishandling classified information and jeopardizing national security. He acted without authorization and in dereliction of his duty to follow the policies and regulations established by both the FBI and the Department of Justice. In doing so, he demeaned the work of the agency he led, damaging the integrity of the nation's premier law enforcement agency, and breached the public's trust. In various congressional appearances, Comey offered a variety of excuses for why he thought extraordinary circumstances demanded him to engage in extra-legal actions. None of them justified violating the fundamental rule of law, as Comey did. Within 2 weeks after the U.S. Senate confirmed Rod Rosenstein as Deputy Attorney General, he authored a report that recommended to the President that Comey be fired. The FBI Director reports directly to the Deputy AG, so in that context, President Trump acted expeditiously in accepting Rosenstein's counsel. The President appeared to think this move would be treated as a win-win. Over the previous year, both parties had accused Comey of incompetence, grandstanding, and attempting to sway the presidential election one way or the other. This early in his tenure, President Trump still underestimated the Democrats' fecklessness. Democrats, of course, were quick to condemn the president for discharging Comey. Many of them were the same politicians who denounced the director in late October 2016 for abusing his authority and unduly influencing the election when he sent a letter to congressional leaders briefly reopening the Clinton case only days before the election. But in Washington, hypocrisy is endemic and memories are fleeting. However, the greatest hysteria over Comey's firing emanated from the media. Comparisons to Richard Nixon's infamous Saturday Night Massacre abounded, with accusations that Trump used the bungled Clinton case as an excuse for firing Comey and that the president's true purpose was to quash the Trump-Russia probe. This demonstrated that most talking heads know little about presidential history and how FBI investigations work. The director's departure did not stop the Bureau's ongoing probe into Russian meddling and any alleged collusion. It was Comey who was dismissed, not the career professionals at the agency. The counterintelligence case continued, and so too did congressional investigations into the same matter. They did not miss a beat, but the media frenzy advanced unabated because so many who occupy newsrooms across America harbor unabashed contempt for Trump and his unconventional approach to governing. Comey's lack of integrity and defiance of rules and principles of law were his downfall. His unchecked ambition and desire to thrust himself into the public limelight only exacerbated his mistakes of judgment and deed. Rosenstein's scathing critique of how Comey abused his authority, usurped the power of the Attorney General, and broke FBI-DOJ rules is worth reviewing. I cannot defend the director's handling of the conclusion of the investigation of Secretary Clinton's emails, and I do not understand his refusal to accept the nearly universal judgment that he was mistaken. Almost everyone agrees that the director made serious mistakes. It is one of the few issues that unites people of diverse perspectives. My perspective on these issues is shared by former attorneys general and deputy attorneys general from different eras and both political parties. In his 3-page summary, Rosenstein detailed multiple acts of misconduct by Comey. The FBI director took it upon himself to assume the powers and duties of the Attorney General in deciding the Clinton case and chose to announce his findings without notice to the Justice Department in a nationwide news conference. This was in clear contravention of regulations that restrict certain conduct by FBI employees. As Rosenstein noted, the FBI director is never empowered to supplant federal prosecutors and assume command of the Justice Department. The director announced his own conclusions about the nation's most sensitive criminal investigation without the authorization of duly appointed Justice Department leaders. Comey should have determined whether there was evidence to justify prosecution, then turned the matter over to federal prosecutors to decide whether an indictment of Clinton was warranted. Rosenstein cited the opinions of 6 former top Justice Department officials who all agree. Comey's obstinate refusal to admit his errors only reinforced the need to fire him. In a stinging rebuke, Rosenstein added, "The FBI is unlikely to regain public and congressional trust until it has a director who understands the gravity of the mistakes and pledges never to repeat them." Hence, Comey was canned for reasons that were entirely justified, an apoplectic media and howling Democrats notwithstanding. Almost immediately, demands for impeachment of President Trump were heard in the corridors of Congress. The liberal media was crazed with excitement over the prospect that the president had obstructed justice in trying to block the Russian investigation. In truth and in law, neither scenarios were remotely rational. Chapter 10. Obstruction of Justice. Men are more often bribed by their loyalties and ambitions than by money. Justice Robert H. Jackson, United States versus Wunderlich, 342 United States Supreme Court, page 98, 1951. There's nothing wrong with ambition, but ambition without character or principles is what turns good men into bad men. They well know right from wrong, but are too willing to hide the truth in favor of advancing their own designs. Their loyalty is to themselves alone. It is therefore ironic that James Comey, the fired FBI director, penned a tome entitled A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. The real truth is that Comey's unchecked ambition is what led to his demise. It is the classic story of how power corrupts. Comey took it upon himself to decide Hillary Clinton's fate in the email scandal that bedeviled her 2016 presidential campaign. He presumptuously exceeded his authority, mangled the rule of law, and arrogated partisanship over principles. His superiors at the Department of Justice eventually condemned his actions. They found that he flouted rules and deeply ingrained traditions and guaranteed that some people would accuse the FBI of interfering in the election. Indeed, many Americans did. For this, he was appropriately fired. But Comey was unchastened and determined to avenge the indignity of his dismissal. The notion of how to do it came to him, he said, when he awakened in the middle of the night. He resolved to leak government documents he had furtively taken from FBI headquarters to harm President Trump. It was an act of shameless hypocrisy, since Comey had promised the president, "I don't do sneaking things, I don't leak, I don't do weasel moves." Thus, the man who had previously been asked to enforce the law against leakers became a notorious leaker himself. He also became the chief witness in a politically motivated, albeit misguided, attempt to accuse the president of obstructing justice. Comey fashioned himself the innocent victim in what became, at its core, a clever plan to incriminate Trump for words and deeds that bore no resemblance to the law of obstruction. Trump did not obstruct Flynn case. The day after the February 13, 2017 resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, a national security meeting was convened in the Oval Office at the White House. Vice President Mike Pence, FBI Director James Comey, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and other senior security officials attended. According to Comey, President Trump asked the FBI director to remain behind as others departed. A conversation allegedly ensued in which the Flynn case was discussed. Here is Comey's account as told to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence when he testified 4 months later. The president then returned to the topic of Mike Flynn, saying, "He is a good guy and he's been through a lot." He repeated that Flynn hadn't done anything wrong on his calls with the Russians, but had misled the vice president. He then said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go." I replied only that, "He is a good guy. In fact, I had a positive experience dealing with Mike Flynn when he was a colleague as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency at the beginning of my term at the FBI. I did not say I would let this go." Comey's story of what Trump is supposed to have said was contained in a memorandum composed by the director. After he was fired, he arranged for it to be delivered secretly to the New York Times. Comey did not want to leak it himself, so he gave his memo to a friend, a law professor, with instructions that it be surreptitiously conveyed to the media. It was a quintessential maneuver by Comey, sneaky, underhanded, and self-serving. He wanted to damage Trump after being sacked, but he didn't want to dirty his own hands with the actual deed. Later, during his Senate Intelligence Committee testimony, Comey came clean, perhaps realizing that he would eventually be found out and did not want to run the risk of perjuring himself. But along with his admission, he offered an astonishing explanation for his motivation. He did it for the sole purpose of triggering the appointment of a special counsel in a blatant effort to manipulate the legal process against Trump. He bragged about what he'd managed to accomplish. If ever there was an act of retribution or vengeance, this was it. But it also constituted an apparent crime by Comey, which will be discussed later in this chapter. Thanks to Comey's engineered leak, the mainstream media immediately ran stories claiming that Trump's remarks were evidence of obstruction of justice for attempting to derail any investigation into Flynn's conduct. But wait. What investigation? When Comey met with Trump, the director already knew that Flynn had told the truth when he was interviewed by FBI agents in January. The investigation should have been closed. Why wasn't Comey honest and forthright with Trump by telling him that Flynn had largely been cleared by his agents of any wrongdoing? Flynn's conversation was perfectly legal and not a violation of the Logan Act, which Comey surely knew. And Flynn's responses to the agents who questioned him were deemed by them to be truthful, which Comey also knew. Comey's unconscionable deception leaves three possibilities. First, there never was a conversation with Trump about the fired NSA, meaning Comey invented it to harm Trump. Second, Comey embellished his account of what was said. Or third, there was a discussion about Flynn facing legal jeopardy, but Comey concealed the fact that Flynn had done nothing that violated the law. In each case, Comey appears to have been dishonest. The White House responded to Comey's leak by denying the conversation, stating, While the president has repeatedly expressed his view that General Flynn is a decent man who served and protected our country, the president has never asked Mr. Comey or anyone else to end any investigation, including any investigation involving General Flynn. The statement went on to say, "This is not a truthful or accurate portrayal of the conversation between the president and Mr. Comey." Months later, Trump repeated his denial when he tweeted, "I never asked Comey to stop investigating Flynn. Just more fake news covering another Comey lie." Comey's testimony about his conversation with Trump prompted widespread speculation among Democrats and the media that the former director's good friend Robert Mueller would use his appointment as special counsel to bring charges against the president for obstruction of justice, or, at the very least, a report that could be used for impeachment proceedings by Congress. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is not a lawyer but is the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, surmised, "What we're beginning to see is the putting together of a case of obstruction of justice." Feinstein should have gone to law school. Obstruction of justice is defined in a series of statutes, the most relevant of which is Title 18 of the USC, Section 1505. "Whoever corruptly influences, obstructs, or impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the due and proper administration of the law under which any pending proceeding is being had before any department or agency of the United States shall be fined under this title, imprisoned not more than 5 years, or both." A pending proceeding would include an FBI investigation. As noted in Chapter 2, the operative word in the statute is corruptly. Because it is a somewhat fungible term that can be subject to varying interpretations, it was given an explicit meaning in a subsequent code section, Title 18 of the USC, Section 1515B, which also included examples of specific acts that would constitute behaving corruptly. As used in Section 1505, the term corruptly means acting with an improper purpose, personally or by influencing another, including making a false or misleading statement, or withholding, concealing, altering, or destroying a document or other information. Assuming Comey's account of what Trump said is true on its face, the president's words or actions do not satisfy any of the examples of a corrupt or improper purpose stated in the statute. No false statements, no withholding or concealing, and no altering or destroying evidence have been alleged by Comey or anyone else. Did Trump do any of those things or ask the director to do them? Reread Comey's statement. The answer is no. Obstruction of justice is a specific intent crime, which means a person must specifically intend to obstruct or interfere with an investigation. Proof is dependent on the precise consciousness and purpose of the actor, in this case, Trump. There was nothing specific in the words the president allegedly used. His allusions to Flynn were vague and ambiguous. They could be interpreted in a variety of ways and with different meanings. Obstruction is an easy accusation for someone like Feinstein and the media to throw around, but it is exceedingly difficult for a prosecutor to prove in a court of law because the wording of the statute is exact and unequivocal. Indeed, courts have interpreted it quite narrowly. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Arthur Anderson versus United States, defined the term corruptly as it applies to a companion obstruction statute, Title 18 of the USC, Section 1512, as follows: wrongful, immoral, depraved, or evil. The High Court ruled that consciousness of wrongdoing is required. Let's compare this to the words allegedly uttered by Trump. The president is supposed to have said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, letting Flynn go. He's a good guy. I hope you can let this go." Trump's statement bears no resemblance to the requirements of the statute or the Supreme Court explanation of a corrupt purpose. There is no lie, threat, or bribe, and no pernicious act. Trump's words were not immoral, depraved, or evil in any sense. Under no legal interpretation could the president have obstructed justice. Former Special Assistant U.S. Attorney at the Department of Justice Fred Tesi argues that the president's remarks do not come close to satisfying the legal requirements of obstruction of justice. At the time of the conversation with Comey, the FBI director was aware that Flynn had been truthful with the FBI. Trump didn't know that, but Comey did. So it begs the question as to how Trump could form the requisite intent to corruptly influence an investigation that, at that point, was not even an investigation, or at best, had revealed that Flynn had done nothing wrong. Trump's words were aspirational. How Comey took them is of no avail. The question is Trump's state of mind at the time, and these words fail to indicate any intent to corruptly obstruct or impede anything. Hoping or wishing for an outcome is not the same as directing or ordering someone to end an investigation or clear a suspect. By contrast, if the president had said, "Bury whatever incriminating evidence you might have, exonerate Flynn, and end the investigation of him entirely or you're fired," that might, arguably, constitute obstruction of justice. It would include two corrupt elements, a threat and concealing evidence. It would also be regarded as an edict or mandate to stop the Flynn investigation. Of course, this analysis ignores the fact that the president denies he ever spoke the words ascribed to him. With no known witnesses to corroborate Comey's claim, a prosecutor would be loath to consider bringing such a case based on one person's word. It is the definition of reasonable doubt. President Trump's remarks about Flynn, if true, were not a directive to drop the investigation of him. It was not even a request, although Comey claimed he perceived it to be. His perception of what he heard is not, under the law, what proves obstruction. It is the specific intent of the speaker. In his introductory statement to the Senate Intelligence Committee, Comey asserted, "I had understood the president to be requesting that we drop any investigation of Flynn in connection with false statements about his conversation with the Russian ambassador in December." How Comey interpreted the president's words is irrelevant. As the statute makes plain, the intent of the person speaking the words proves obstruction, not how the listener may construe it. Comey was schooled in the law and knew that his story of the Oval Office meeting was not obstruction of justice at all. During his Intelligence Committee appearance, Senator James Risch posed the key question. "Senator Risch, do you know of any case where a person has been charged for obstruction of justice, or for that matter, any other criminal offense where they said or thought they hoped for an outcome?" Comey: "I don't know well enough to answer. The reason I keep saying his words is I took it as a direction." Comey's answer was a misdirection. He claimed he really couldn't answer, then shifted to how he interpreted the president's words, which is irrelevant under the obstruction statute. Senator Risch continued to pursue the issue. Senator Risch: "You don't know of anyone being charged for hoping something. Is that a fair statement?" Comey: "I don't as I sit here." Intelligence Committee Chairman Senator Richard Burr asked Comey quite directly whether he thought the president was trying to obstruct justice. As expected, Comey demurred by claiming, "I don't think it's for me to say whether the conversation I had with the president was an effort to obstruct." His response was curious. Comey was all too willing to usurp the authority of the Attorney General in deciding that Clinton broke no laws, but was reluctant to say whether Trump did. While there was no legal basis for declining to answer the pivotal question, Comey dodged the answer for a reason. If he had said under oath that he regarded the president's words as obstruction, Comey might have incriminated himself in a crime known as misprision of felony, Title 18 of the U.S.C. Section 4. Misprision of a felony is similar to aiding and abetting a crime or accessory after the fact. It requires a showing that someone has knowledge of a felony and conceals it. What constitutes concealment? The case most often cited, Neal versus United States, stated, "There must be a concealment of something such as suppression of the evidence or other positive act." In that case, evidence of a theft crime was allegedly stored or concealed in a golf bag. Comey composed his memo and stored it somewhere until he was fired as FBI director. He either kept it at his home or took it with him when he was terminated. Either way, he considered it to be of significant value. One could argue that he regarded the memo as evidence of a felony, obstruction, and took affirmative steps to suppress it until he later chose to leak it to the media. Which is more likely? Comey thought he would get away with misprision of a felony, or he thought the memo looked bad enough to be used as a political shield if he's ever fired? Why did he wait several months, and only after he was cashiered, to act on his memo? People who serve in law enforcement have a special duty to immediately report knowledge of a felony to a person of higher authority, not simply bury it somewhere in a file or take it home to use sometime in the future for blackmail or retribution. The FBI director's superior is the Deputy Attorney General at the Department of Justice. In his testimony, Comey admitted he did not inform anyone at the DOJ. His excuse was that he did not think the deputy AG would be in that position for very long, which is no excuse at all. Thus, it is reasonable to conclude that Comey did not believe the president obstructed justice, and he therefore had no duty to report it. Comey was pressed on this issue during his hearing. Unbelievably, he claimed he did not know whether FBI officials have a duty to report a crime that has been committed. Question. You're unsure whether they would have a legal duty? Comey. That's a good question. I've not thought about that before. There is a statute that prohibits misprision of a felony, knowing of a felony and taking steps to conceal it. But this is a different question. Let me be clear. I would expect any FBI agent who has information about a crime to report it. Comey expected his agents to report evidence of crimes, yet he did not do so himself. He filed away his memo, took no action, and never informed the Justice Department. His actions indicate he knew his memo was not evidence of a crime. He well recognized that the president's comments about Flynn did not have a corrupt or improper purpose, and were never intended to obstruct or impede an investigation that had already found no wrongdoing by the National Security Advisor. Comey's memo was treated as a smoking gun only because the media and Democrats, prompted by the former director himself, peddled it that way. At most, the Oval Office conversation was an uncomfortable encounter. But that did not stop Comey from exploiting it later to smear the man who fired him. In this respect, the ex-director succeeded. Although the president's supposed remarks about Flynn appeared to be more of an observation than an order, Trump could have ordered Comey to end any criminal pursuit of his former NSA and been acting well within his authority to do so. This was conceded by Comey during his testimony when he endorsed what many constitutional scholars have long maintained. That is, the president has broad constitutional powers to stop investigations and potential prosecutions. I am not a legal scholar, but as a legal matter, the president is the head of the executive branch and could direct, in theory, anyone being investigated or not. I think he has the legal authority. All of us ultimately report in the executive branch to the president. On this point, Comey was right. Article 2 of the Constitution contains what is known as the vesting clause. It states, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States." This means he has full power over the executive branch of government, and his decisions are not subject to congressional restraint. He can direct any agency or department to take whatever course of action he deems appropriate, or, in the alternative, to refrain from taking action. In this case, Trump was empowered to order Comey to end his pursuit of Flynn, although that is not what he did. Alan Dershowitz, professor at Harvard Law School and a prominent constitutional scholar, argued that Trump's actions were perfectly permissible and historically supported. Until recently, presidents from Adams to Jefferson to Lincoln to Roosevelt to Kennedy played active roles in deciding who to investigate and prosecute. In recent years, a tradition had developed under which the FBI and the Criminal Division of the Justice Department were more independent of the White House. But this tradition did not and could not limit the constitutional authority of the president, especially in the absence of legislation. It is clear, therefore, that Trump acted within his constitutional authority if he directed Comey to end his investigation of Flynn. It follows from this that he certainly acted within his authority if he merely requested or hoped that Comey would stand down. Dershowitz was wise to emphasize the importance of presidential precedent. No one ever accused President Obama of obstructing justice when, in a televised interview on Fox News, he acknowledged that Hillary Clinton was careless in mishandling classified documents, but insisted she did not jeopardize national security. This was a thinly disguised statement to the FBI and the Justice Department that he did not want her to be prosecuted. He did not hope or wish that she be cleared. Obama articulated a very specific statement tailored to the law that his former Secretary of State should be absolved of any wrongdoing. He didn't need to issue a direct order to Comey or Attorney General Loretta Lynch. His nationally televised words conveyed the unmistakable message not to bring criminal charges against Clinton, incriminating evidence notwithstanding. Right on cue, Comey reacted to Obama's statement as the president surely intended. The director adopted Obama's argument in nearly identical language when he announced that Clinton had been extremely careless but had not intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information. Comey acceded to the president's wishes. Yet never once did Comey complain that Obama was interfering in or obstructing a potential prosecution, although the president's intent that the case be dropped can plainly be inferred from his words. If Obama did not obstruct justice, neither did Trump. Under the First Amendment, both were entitled to express their opinions about the respective cases and the individuals involved. Indeed, under the vesting clause, both presidents could have been far more aggressive in ordering an end to the probes. They would have been well within their constitutional powers to do so. The only reason Trump has been accused of obstruction is because Comey, Democrats, and the liberal media shaped it into one of their favorite anti-Trump narratives. It is part of a much larger narrative casting Trump's unusual style as breaking the law when he's only breaking the establishment's unwritten rules. In making decisions on who should or should not be prosecuted, the FBI and DOJ have enormous latitude. So too does the president, who can command the direction of their investigations and prosecutions or instruct that cases not be pursued. This is a legitimate executive function derived from the Take Care Clause in Article 2 of the Constitution, which states that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Such decisions invariably involve judgment and discretion. Eugene Kantorovich, law professor at Northwestern University, made this point when he observed, "No laws are enforced 100%. Lots of people commit crimes. Lots of prosecutors know about them and decide not to charge those crimes. Executive discretion and prioritization are part of the justice system." A prime example of such discretion can be found in President Obama's executive action to shield millions of undocumented immigrants from prosecution and deportation. Was the president obstructing justice by actively interfering in potential prosecutions? No. While it is true that litigation ensued to reverse the president's order, no one argued that his action to halt prosecutions constituted obstruction under the law. Whereas Obama had issued a written order directing that prosecutions be deferred or dropped, Trump merely expressed a hope that Flynn would be cleared. The same mainstream media and Democrats who applauded Obama for his expressed order condemned Trump for his vague and elastic comments to Comey. Former Assistant U.S. Attorney Doug Burns dismisses the notion that Trump obstructed justice in his comments to Comey about Flynn. The Trump statement to Comey was certainly ill-advised, however, it did not amount to obstruction of justice. First, the statute requires evidence of a corrupt intent, and nothing in the statement provides any such evidence. Second, the president can direct the Justice Department to drop a case as he is the Attorney General's boss. Last, the president can pardon Michael Flynn. As such, his statement alone does not amount to obstruction of justice. There was no evidence the president acted corruptly or with an improper purpose as the law of obstruction requires. Those who accused him of it either misunderstood the statutes and case law or deliberately misinterpreted them for political reasons. Firing Comey was not obstruction of justice. President Trump's firing of Comey did not constitute obstruction of justice for many of the same reasons that his conversation about Flynn did not rise to the level of obstruction. The president is constitutionally authorized to fire any political appointee in the executive branch of government. They report to him and serve at his pleasure. The best evidence of this came from the words of the man who was fired. The day after he was terminated as FBI director, Comey wrote a letter to his colleagues at the Bureau that stated, "I have long believed that a president can fire an FBI director for any reason or for no reason at all." Comey was correct. Under the Constitution, the president has unfettered power to discharge the FBI director or anyone else in the executive branch who was politically appointed to his or her position. Trump could have offered no reason and been constitutionally entitled to act. However, in Comey's case, Trump had ample cause for firing him. Comey's direct supervisor was the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. As explained in the last chapter, Rosenstein spelled out several incidents of serious malfeasance by Comey in his mishandling of the Clinton email case that more than justified the decision, and the deputy AG recommended to the president that the director be dismissed. So too did the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who endorsed the decision. Trump cited these reasons and recommendations in his letter to Comey dated May 9, 2017. Rosenstein's endorsement that Comey be fired had been months in the making. In his testimony before both the House and Senate, he disclosed that he first broached the idea in a discussion with then-Senator Jeff Sessions in the winter of 2016-2017. Hence, it was not a judgment motivated by some nefarious desire to interfere in the Flynn investigation or the Russia probe. The plan had been gestating for several months and predated Trump's conversation with Comey about Flynn. Instead, relieving the director of his duties was an effort to restore the credibility of the FBI because, as Rosenstein described it, Comey had damaged public confidence in the Bureau and Department. The ink was barely dry on Trump's letter firing Comey when the president's critics began assailing the move as a clear case of obstruction of justice. Trump, they proclaimed, was interfering with the Trump-Russia investigation. This was untrue, and the facts do not support the argument. Not only was the president empowered